Hey, real quick, I just wanted to let you know that Gabba Gabba Huh is now a record store. Well, not really a store, but a booth at an antique store located in Eastridge Mall in Gastonia, North Carolina. Vintage Village is three stores down from Dillard's on the left. And my booth is on the left side of Vintage Village. It's the one with all the records. You can't miss it. I've got over 1,000 records, toys, t-shirts, DVDs, VHS, all kinds of stuff there. So come check it out. Gabba Gabba Huh Records and Vintage Goods, located in Vintage Village at Eastridge Mall, Gastonia, North Carolina. You are now listening to the Gabba Gabba Huh Talks podcast, where we bring you conversations with people connected to the Carolinas underground music scene. Your host, Mike Phillips of Van Huskins.
His letters. He'd use scrap paper and cross whatever else out. And
enclosed is something I wrote for your zine. What zine did you do?
I was part of Unadulterated Metal at one point, and I wrote for Indiefile, and then Clayton and I, if you remember, did that Drastic Measures. Mm-hmm. That's what I was going to show you, but I don't know where it is in here right now. It's a piece of his writing that's completely unpublished. Like an original piece of writing.
Yeah. You going to make sure it always stays unpublished?
I'd like to put it out there in some form, but, you know, that's kind of like with rare pictures. Once you put it out there, can't anybody else do what they want with it?
Exactly, yeah.
I'm going to just lock that so somebody doesn't come stumbling in.
Honestly, at one point I could thought about suggesting that I just come out here in the middle of the day. And then when people came in, they become a part of the podcast. But that might be something for down the road. Because I'd like to do a little bit more with, like, doesn't focus on bands as much as it does, like, record stores. And do something like that.
Yeah, we can certainly do it again. And I don't know. We'll toss.
It's just an idea I had. And I just decided against it today. I was like, well, no.
Because, you know, I've done a podcast before, and I've got another guy wanting to do one after you and I do this one, and I want to do something in depth on Gigi because I don't think the right stuff has ever been said.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we could always do a podcast where we talk about Gigi the whole time, or, you know, for a good bit of it, because even though I focus local, I've thought about going outside that sphere a little bit.
It's just, it's always the same old shit. I want people to know about Gigi as a person. Mm-hmm. Hardly no one knows that.
Yeah, everybody knows about Gigi, the myth, or the what you saw on stage. I don't want to call it a character, but it was partially a, you know, well, from what I understand, that was Gigi, but Gigi was also this other person. And that other person was a really good person. One of the best friends you could have.
I would agree with that. Yeah.
But I wouldn't know because I never met the guy. And really, I kind of regret the fact that I remember when he played that last show at the church. But I didn't go.
You came close to meeting him because one of those shows the Furies did at Heretics, I was trying to get him out there. He was in Charlotte. Mm-hmm. But he and that Liz girl were so tumultuous all the time. Like, they'd get into it at the drop of a hat, and he didn't make it. I consider it one of the most important things from that time in my life.
Mm-hmm. Heck yeah. Well, let's get started.
Yeah, let's start it.
Today I'm talking to, I don't know what name you go by, Robert or Rob or Robbie or Suave or, but what would you prefer to be called these days?
Robert
Everett.
And you'll find people from the old days that still call me Robbie at times or Suave.
Yeah. I know I've referred to you as Suave when talking to other people because it's like Eric knows you by Suave. And but I've recently said something to somebody. I'm like, I really don't know what he goes by these days, if it's Robert or if he just wants to be called Rob or something. So we've got that out of the way.
Yes, sir.
And we first met like back in 1993 or around that time, maybe even earlier than that. We played some shows together in 93, but we may have met earlier than that, like at Repo Records, Repo Cheapo. But
Repo Cheapo would have opened that same year, 1993.
Yeah. So I knew it was all kind of around that same time. But I played in a band called Popes on Dope at the time, and you played in a band called The Furies. And we'll talk a little bit about
that's
that.
That's correct.
Talk a little bit about that in a little while. But that was really our first experience playing a show in a club as teenagers was playing with you guys. So I think that was our very first show.
I hope it was a good first experience.
Oh yeah, it was great. I was hooked immediately. But let's step back further than that though and talk about sort of how you got into music as a kid. Like, what's one of the earliest things you remember about music that really kind of grabbed you?
That even though, you know, he ended up being a very disappointing person later in life, that I had a father who turned me on to all the varied music that he loved, whether it be Bo Diddley or the Spinners or Buddy Holly or the Hollies.
Mm-hmm.
And he ended up working at one point in Belk as the personnel manager. And Belk, you'll remember, always had the cutout department, mm-hmm, of vinyl.
Yeah.
And he would bring me those home. So all I had at the time was a Romper Room record player. And the first album I put on it that he handed to me was Edwin Starr's War and Peace.
Okay, yeah. About how old were you at this time?
I'd say less than 10 years old.
Yeah, yeah. That's a good place to get started. That's a interesting place to get started, actually.
So that was certainly beneficial to me to have a father who was a music lover. And, you know, he liked to regale me with stories of, he even saw Bo Diddley back in the day, and he liked to talk about Beatles versus the Stones. Mm-hmm. He said, you were either or, you weren't both. And like, the Beatles people were the goody goodies and the Stones people were the rebels. Yeah, and he was a Stones person.
Yeah, yeah. I remember had that debate at many times in everybody's life. I think everybody's talked about the Beatles or the Stones, and I think I've been a little bit of both at one point or another. And these days I just love both of them so much.
Right. That's the true freedom, isn't it? On music, when you learn you don't have to choose.
Yeah, exactly.
The Bo Diddley story is a real short one, but it's worth repeating. He saw him in some bar when he was attending UNC Chapel Hill, and somebody was heckling him. And Bo just stopped the show and got up to the mic and he said, don't you know, Bo Diddley don't take no shit. My mother loved music too, but what you would expect from a teenage girl who grew up during that time, her records, I still have them all now, are Elvis and Ricky Nelson and things like that.
Of course, yeah. All good stuff. So what did you do with music from there? Did you start buying your own records, or I mean, just how what was your relationship with music as a child?
My father, you know, I don't know exactly when that turn happened, but he wanted to live his life over through me, mm-hmm, because I was naturally very adept at sports, like more so than he ever was.
Yeah,
had a physical prowess for running, especially, and he didn't like it when my interest turn from sports back to music. Mm,
okay.
So I probably started buying some of my own records in the early 80s. And also in the early 80s, I bought my first guitar from Reliable Music. It was like a white Ibanez Strat-looking guitar.
Okay. What made you want to play guitar? Just the music itself, or did...
I had all that stuff, some of which you probably shared, hanging on my walls in junior high, from Motley Crue to Quiet Riot, Rat, and I would look at those pictures, and oftentimes Vince Neil surrounded by all these good-looking women, and say, like, I want that to be me, and, you know, that's your dream at that time.
I love the honesty about that, because a lot of people don't really come out and say that, but it really is. I mean, as a kid, you think, well, if I want to be a rock star, I can have all these beautiful women.
That's right.
It's every nerd's dream as a kid. And so you fall in love with heavy metal and see that. But yeah, that's kind of me too. I was like, I wanted to play guitar and be like Jimi Hendrix or Eddie Van Halen or whatever. But it wasn't until punk rock that I realized that's where I needed to be.
Money and women.
Yeah,
that's what we dreamed about.
Exactly, yeah. You'd see them riding down the road in the limo with the hot tub in the back. That's what I want to do.
Most people today wouldn't even know that that was a possibility. Back then, before I started buying my own records, the library not too far from my house, you could check out record albums. And that's when I would have first heard Stevie Ray Vaughan.
Oh, yeah.
And I had more than one chance to see him back then, and I didn't go.
Yeah. Yeah, that would have been awesome.
But yeah, the first record I bought with my own money was Hendrix's Smash Hits, and that didn't sit well with my father, because he'd served in the Army during Vietnam, and he didn't like hippies, and I was lining up with the kind of people he'd used to see outside the post office burning their draft cards.
Yeah, I can see that, coming from that era.
So it was like, I don't understand, why would you like that? I do remember within the next couple of years, one day I was playing records in my room, and he overheard that live version of Jimmy doing Johnny B. Goode, and he liked it.
Yeah. So you said you got a guitar around this time, too. Do you remember how old you were when you bought the guitar?
Junior high.
Junior high age. Did you start a band at that time, or did it take a while to learn to play?
No, it took me a while. I had a good ear. My mother's mother always had a good musical ear. She played the organ, and she never had any formal training or lesson. She learned by ear.
Okay.
And that made its way down to me. I could listen to records and figure most things out. Mm-hmm. And then, as you've already heard in the past, fast forward a little bit, that would have been my second job, was at Auto Bell Car Wash. That's how I met Fred Hutchinson, a.k.a. Freddie Hutch.
Yep.
And he's the one who I credit with really teaching me how to more so play guitar. And in that, I mean, like, this is so much more valuable learning from someone like that in a practical way, other than going and paying for lessons, because he taught me things like feel and soul and picking style.
Instead of chords and finger positions and all that, you know, technical stuff they do in like a regular guitar lesson, it turns a lot of people off, you know, because they want to be able to, if you'd send a kid to a guitar lesson, if the first thing they'd do is teach them a power chord and just show them how to do that, that would make a lot of people happy. And then they could start working on the chords, but just teach them a power chord and show them how to make a sound, how to play a song, teach them how to play, you know, Louie Louie.
Well, it suddenly made sense. It was as different as like looking at a foreign language you've never seen before on a page versus, you know, wiping it clean. Like, all he had to do is sit in front of me and say, oh, what do you like? What might you like to learn first? And he would play it, and I'd say, well, that makes sense now.
What band was Fred playing at the time?
30-Foot Beast. 30-Foot Beast.
So you started learning a little bit from Fred. Now, did you start a band around this time at all, or were you still just kind of getting the feel of playing?
No, still no band, but Fred was the key in me meeting, around that same time, another one of the most important people in my life. Fred's the reason that I met David Vincent from Morbid Angel. Yeah. We all worked at Auto Bell together. I mean, all of us eventually, but prior to David and Morbid Angel working there with us, David came over to a party at Freddie Hutch's house, and I was there at the same time, and we really hit it off from there. And I'm only touching on this because it transcends just the surface things of, oh, David Vincent of Morbid Angel or Jenna Tortures, he's a rock star, he's famous, he's done this and that. Like, he was a very inspirational person to me in ways that have lasted to this day.
And a lot of people seem to tend to forget he's a part of the North Carolina scene. I mean, they started in North Carolina. So that's, you know, we kind of forget about that because they moved away and got big after they left here.
Yes, sir. That's an ongoing and common misconception. I think people have asked me about that within the last month. Morbid Angel, they were from Florida. Well, yes, they were, but David had a record label at the time called Gorak Records. It was a foundling record label. Originally, they relocated to Charlotte to join that record label and have David manage them. But at the same time, their lineup fell apart, and David had been wanting to do more extreme types of music, so he joined up. Yeah, David was a native Charlatan and went to South Mac.
Yeah. So it's important that he gets mentioned on this and that you bring this up.
Yes, sir. Yeah, he was secondary to basic life, apply it to life type things that I would have gotten from my father. David, to me, was a person that, you know, any situation, he'd be like, well, what are you going to do if this happens or this happens? Like, he wanted to teach you, like, what you needed in life to step up and get things done. And he was only a couple years older than me, so he was an exceptionally inspirational human being to be that young. One time I said to him, he felt I was giving him too much credit for things I've done or where I've gone in life. He said, you already had that in you. All I did was stoke the fire. But we spent a lot of time together after meeting him through Fred, whether it be talking about our favorite authors or going out to the movies together or watching horror movies on VHS in his bedroom or going up to Camelot Music.
Yeah.
And, you know, people have asked me, like, well, did you have any idea at the time? Because I was typically the only person they would let into that Oakland house while they were practicing and writing Altars of Madness in the afternoons. Did you have any idea? Yes, I did. Because I went back to high school and I would tell people, like, I know you people like Metallica and Slayer and you think that's as far as it goes these days, but you have no idea.
This would be like the late 80s, I
guess. This would have been from circa 85 to 87.
Okay.
When I was around Morbid Angel the most, Wayne Hartzell was still in the band, and I'm still in touch with Wayne, and he still lives in the area. Back then, people need to understand, too, that it wasn't easy, and the way you found out about other bands was through tape trading and demo tapes. Mm-hmm. And Trey and David always had these new and obscure demo tapes from all parts of the world, and they discovered Terrorizer, and from that moment, they decided that Pete Sandoval was going to be their drummer, and they made it happen. They just would put me in front of that with them and say, listen to this. It's insane. We've never heard anybody play a blast beat like that. David asked me within the last few years, like, so that house we lived in on Oakland, like, I could have gotten that for nothing back then, and I hear now that's like a $1 million house. I said, you got that right.
Somebody posted on Facebook a while back on the market or something. Like, holy shit, that really?
Back then, they shared the kitchen with rats almost as big as a small dog.
I've heard a few stories about that place, so that's legendary for sure.
I was, you know, I had a secondhand car to use at the time through my father, and every afternoon after school, that's usually to where I made a beeline.
Yeah. So how long was it before you started to put a band together?
I mean, unless you want to include, like, meeting people of like minds and jamming around and things like that, I was 2 years at UNC Greensboro,
okay.
And I did some of that during that time, but it would be, like, after I came back to Charlotte after that, before I had a band that actually played anywhere.
Yeah. And when you moved back to Charlotte, put a band together, what was that, failure, or did you do something before?
No, I had a band called Dream Theory,
okay,
where I was the singer, and probably the most notable person from that you may be in any way familiar with would be Adam Roth, who went to be in Laburnum.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I don't know how to describe it without you hearing it. I mean, we played to a pretty good crowd at 4808, and Mike Plumides was very fond of it. And if you said it had an early, like, U2 sound to it, you wouldn't be wrong.
Nothing wrong with early U2. I'm not a big fan of late U2.
Right.
I'm not really a big fan of early U2. There's nothing wrong with it.
Right. Today, it's nothing I would listen to either. But, you know, you making me recall this as far as a timeline goes, I wouldn't have done that in years, so that had to be a very quick transition. me returning to Charlotte after those couple years away at Greensboro and doing that band, and then, you know, the transgression into punk rock music. I'm not really clear on the timeline there, but it had to be quick.
Yeah. Well, you already listened. You were already listening to punk rock at that time, though, right?
Yes,
sir. Just weren't playing it with that group of guys.
I was always a seeker. You know, I told you my father was, and his musical taste was a big influence on me. But as soon as I had a way to get to junk stores, thrift stores, flea markets, I was voraciously seeking out records just by the handful. And I would just, that's the way I learned back then. I would take them home and play them and weed through and see what I liked and what I didn't like.
Yeah, we did a lot of that. Just, I mean, if it was at a thrift store, although I wonder some of the things I left behind at the thrift store that were actually really good. But I know we'd buy a lot of things just based on, I'm willing to listen to that. And I don't remember how much they were back then. I know here they're like 50 cents now. I figure they might have been a quarter back then. But yeah, whatever they were, it was just, it was worth it to buy it and see what it sounded
they
like.
They were much more plentiful back then.
Yeah, they were. They were a lot more plentiful. Every now and then I run across a bounty of them, but it's rare. I usually find like some good country records every now and then, but a lot of gospel.
So, I mean, as you well know, I know it will run parallel for you. When you're in any way in that scene of metal or punk or hardcore, you encounter a lot of people who are very tunnel visioned and narrow minded and, oh, you can only listen to this or this or this. I was never like that.
Yeah.
So
I've talked about that on this podcast before too. Like a lot of my friends went punk rock and then it's like punk rock or nothing. But we might have done that for a minute, but then it was like, you know, I bought a Motley Crue record from you a little while ago. I was like, man, I still like Motley Crue, so I'm still gonna listen to that. But it was still like, you know, anything and everything. We listened to reggae and hip hop and just we took it all in. We wanted more and more. We wanted to hear more music and all different styles. And it's like you, I guess I was kind of a seeker. I wanted to find out what that band was like. I wanted to hear what they sounded like.
Well, and to this day, like, you'll find that most people just can't wrap their brain around that I love Otis Redding as much as I love Black Sabbath.
Yeah. The older I get, the more that becomes true too, the wider my tastes get. Like, I mean, I never thought I'd be buying like gospel records, but I buy some gospel records, country gospel records, just to hear them, just because I'm going to listen to them at least once. And then I'm not religious by any means, but there's something about listening to a gospel record on a Sunday morning.
Oh, especially the old Fire and Brimstone quartets. Mm-hmm. I love that stuff.
Yeah. And I just never thought as a teenager, even when I thought that my musical tastes were broad, I never thought I'd listen to that stuff. I mean, I barely listened to country back then. Now it's about all I listen to.
This is something interesting I touched on with some friends of mine recently. Famous entertainers aren't immune to that way of thought. The example I'm going to give is within the last few years, I was fortunate enough to have the right set of circumstances where I met the OJs.
Okay.
And I'm standing there and in front of Eddie LaVert, and he's meant the world to me since I was a little kid watching him on Soul Train, and I'm trying to convey these things, and he just has this astonished blank look on his face, and he's like, are you for real? And I said, I wouldn't say any of this unless I meant it from the heart.
Yeah.
And he was like, okay, but like looking at me, he couldn't see past that, the possibility that what he did could have affected that wide a span of people.
Yeah. That's interesting.
I said, just watching you sing for me has always been like infectious because you're not just singing a song and you're not just singing your song. When it happens, it overtakes you. It becomes your entire body. Your whole being, it's electric, it's kinetic. He said, you get it. Yep. You're right. He's like, it's nothing I could have controlled even if I wanted to.
Yeah.
I mean, for me, he was one of the most exciting, joyful singers to ever watch in music history.
Yeah.
And, you know, this was following a performance, and there he is apologizing about his vocals to me. I said, you're not hearing it like I heard it. You have nothing to apologize for.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But, yeah, you know, child of the 70s, you know, I grew up loving all that stuff. Mm-hmm. The OJs and Al Green and Jackson 5, and we could go on.
Yeah, I got exposed
to
all that stuff as a kid, too, and it was just, it stuck with me. There might have been times in my life when I kind of didn't really listen to it much. Of course, it always came back.
But, yeah, that revelation only came to me recently, that famous entertainers,
they kind of see it narrowly, too, sometimes, like what their fan base might be. Yeah.
That's right.
So what'd you do after, I can't remember the name of the band now.
Dream Theory.
Dream Theory. What'd you do after that?
I think it was me aspiring to go into audio engineering at the time, and me gaining a reputation through that and learning it the hard way, mm-hmm. just like going to any club I could or going out with any band I could and like learning it on the spot.
Yeah, how to do sound.
And that would have been everybody from Wicked Ways to Bloody Mary to Seducer. I ended up like doing it a lot for Anti-Scene. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I'm not going to be humble there. I think like once I got my feet wet, like when I was on the board, it was some of the best those different bands sounded.
Yeah.
So I think that's how different people in those areas got to know me and how I must have ended up in that first punk rock band, which existed prior to me, but I joined when it was still under that name, which was Failure.
Okay. That's a name that gets brought up on the podcast every now and then, and it's a name that shares a name with another band, so it's not the Failure that people might know of, unless they're from this area.
That's right.
I was going to have to put that out there because there's a popular band out there called Failure.
So, Failure. When I joined, the lineup would have been Tim Killo, Russ Ward, Brad Mullins, myself, and John Marlowe.
Okay.
And to the best of my recollection, with me joining, Tim Killo exited pretty shortly following, and I guess as a little more time went by, Charles Inman would have joined briefly.
Okay. You played shows with that band. I don't know how many shows, how long you guys went on. But now you played some shows.
As Failure?
As Failure.
I know we played the one at the park elevator.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond that, I can't tell you for sure that I played any more than one show under the name Failure.
Yeah. I didn't know how, like I said, I wasn't really around at that point, so I didn't know how long that band went on or how many shows you did play, but I figured there was at least one.
That one has stuck in my memory because I think I have the only pictures that exist from it.
Okay.
Of us milling around out in the parking lot that day.
Yeah. Do you remember who else was on the bill for that one?
I don't.
Yeah.
I don't. We'd have to dig into the flyer vault answer that. And for anybody listening, unless they're like know the same people you and I do, they probably won't know who Charles Inman is. I'm still in touch with Charles too, but he's credited on Anti-Scene Blood of Freaks EP for doing some background vocals.
Yeah.
He was longtime friends of them, and even more so, like an outrageous character.
Mm-hmm.
In a lot of our lives.
I've heard some stories.
If you've heard that he once ripped a door off a moving car, then that's a true story.
Heard some stories. I don't know that I've ever met him. Somebody asked me that one time. They said, you know Charles, don't you? I'm like, I don't think so. But I've heard the stories.
So we had a good time on the first, if we practiced anywhere prior to that, I don't remember. That had to have been the first place we practiced at. If you know Dave Rames, we practiced at him and his father's house that sat directly behind the Milestone.
Okay.
Fast forward a little bit more, like Brad and I realized we had a unique chemistry for writing songs together.
Yeah.
And the songs got better and better. And in the process of that, like, some other people got pushed out.
Yeah. It happens.
And, I mean, I think what we turned into was really something. I think we really had something for the time we had it. I do recall our first Fury show we ever played at Heretics, and you can attest to this. I mean, those shows, especially for the size of those places mm-hmm. back then, Heretics and the Milestone, were very crowded.
Yeah, they could be.
Really well attended.
Not everyone that my band played, but some of the, I saw plenty of shows out there that were really crowded. Some great shows.
And I think it hit home that we had really accomplished something when following the first Fury show. I remember Jeff Clayton of Anti-Scene comes up to me, his head sort of lowered, and he pauses and he says, "You know, that's not something I would hardly ever say to anyone, but that was very inspiring." Mm-hmm. And I was proud of that.
Yeah. And I want to clarify, when I said not every show that my band played, anytime we played with you guys, I think we did have a really good crowd out there. But we played a couple of shows where we brought bands down from Boone, and they'd give us like a Tuesday night or something. And, you know, we'd have 10 people show up. So that's why I wanted to clarify that. It wasn't just that. It was when my band played on a Tuesday night. We were young, so we'd get out who we could.
And I don't know what to attribute that to. If you have any more vivid memories than I do, please share, like, why as soon as the Fury started there was such a buzz about it.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that club was Heretics in itself was a really unique place and a very interesting place. And it was kind of like you could get away with a lot more out there than you could other places. And I think that drew people in, like, because it was a little bit more fun than some of the other places were. They took a lot more chances.
Mike recently gave me some pictures for anyone listening from a show on Halloween 1993. We shared the bill with his band and a couple other bands. And those pictures brought back to mind, like, the fact that, I don't know if you'll remember this, many times at Heretics when we played, we didn't get paid anything because we owed more in damages. And that would be chairs, pool sticks. Ooh. I mean, you name it. They'd be like, look at this place. It's a disaster.
Yeah. I remember some of that. Now, I'll say, when it comes to Heretics, there's a lot of things I don't remember. Because that was the first place that I was not 21 yet, but that was the first place that was like, "Hey man, you want a beer?" Like, I can't drink. "Hey man, you want a beer?" "Oh yes, I do want a beer." So that was the first place that happened for me. So I don't remember. There's a lot of things I don't remember from that time because I tied one on every time we played.
How young were you when you were playing with us there?
That was 93. So I would have been 19, 20 somewhere. In that, the cusp of that.
Yeah, we had this entire group of, and I don't know how that developed, of rabid fans that would caravan all the way from Statesville to come see us play, which included the notorious Paula. Mm. I know you remember who that is. I mean, anyone who was at those Heretic shows, I don't think could ever forget Paula either. I remember one time in particular, the Furies were playing, and I've got my engineer boot up on the monitor in front of me, and she gets down on her knees and she starts like licking my boot licking while boot. We're playing. So you remember that?
I do remember that, yeah.
Probably the furthest it went as far as something being outlandish. I guess it would have been that club. What was the rock club that was in Hickory for a while back then?
Was it the Wizard Saloon or Cadillacs?
I mean, I'm talking still like early 90s.
Yeah, Cadillacs was one that was, I think, what became, ended up becoming Wizard. But I'm not real familiar with Hickory.
Well, it was a particular Anti-Scene show there. I don't know if we were playing it or not, but I was there either way. And we were all like lingering out back before the show, you know, shooting the shit and what have you. Paula pulls up on her motorcycle. And she says, "You gotta see this. Come over here." And she'd had her motorcycle like airbrushed on one side was Jeff Clayton and the other side was me. And such a shame I don't have a picture of that.
Yeah, yeah, that would be awesome.
She would come to Repo Cheapo, the record store we ran on Central in Charlotte, at least weekly. And as soon as she came through the door, she'd start giggling, like, hee hee hee. She was just so giddy about seeing us both.
Yeah.
That's the way she was with us. I can tell you about a time at Tremont where this drunk redneck guy thought it was open game, and he saw how she was around us, so he reaches out and grabs a big handful of her ass, and she knew where we were. She could see us. So, I mean, Mike, she just swung like 360 with a bottle and took that guy right across the face, yeah. And like blood went pouring.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So that was the mood and environment around a lot of things we lived back at during that time. Anything could happen. I think it's worth telling. Out of those people, like, I by far knew Joe Young first, and I knew him through the record bar, and then Repo.
Yeah.
And he got to know me a good bit and what I liked and what I was about, and he'd been telling Clayton for quite a while, like, there's this guy you have to meet because he's got long sideburns and listens to Curtis Mayfield. And then the way I met Jeff Clayton, we ended up in a screen printing class together at Central Piedmont.
Okay.
And just by my appearance, he figured I was the guy that Joe had been talking about.
Mm-hmm.
That's how all that started.
Yeah.
That was right around the time that they would have put out the, so I remember it was brand new at the time, the Walking Dead single.
Mm-hmm.
I had seen them previous, but I didn't know them. I might have known Joe in passing at that time. I know the first time I ever saw them was at the Church of Musical Awareness with the Lee Howard on bass lineup. And then the second time, which I'm not sure if the facts on that, because I've heard two versions, was with them opening for Danzig on the Danzig 1 tour at the Pterodactyl. And I've heard that may have been Tom O'Keefe's first show. I'm not sure about that.
Yeah.
But I was so pleased to find recently that very show I saw at the church, that's up on YouTube. I don't know if Lee Howard lasted more than one show on bass.
Yeah.
It's taken me years as a grown adult to think about that in a different perspective. Isn't that interesting that the first times I would have seen Anti-Scene, they were only like a 3 or 4 year old band.
Yeah. Because by the time I saw them, it was almost 10 years in.
I'd like to give a couple quick anecdotes on Joe, because I don't hear him talked about very much, at least not that Joe and what a duality he had.
I'd like to have somebody on sometime just to talk about Joe.
Yes, sir. But I have two very strong memories of him when he ran the Repo on Tyvola.
Mm-hmm. I remember that.
And they're totally opposite ends of the spectrum. One is that he always kept his Anti-Scene Telecaster in there.
Mm-hmm.
And he got it out one day and he said, "What's your favorite song? What else do you like? What else do you like?" And he never got enough acknowledgement for that, in my opinion. Like, he had a very unique picking style, and that's what he was showing me, what went into those songs. So that was one side of Joe. And Joe certainly had like a Andy Griffith quality to him. And he and his brother were both fanatical fans of that show.
Yeah.
If something was happening, I mean, that was prior to the days of all this cable and, you know, taping things and watch it later. Like, if they knew the Andy Griffith show was coming on, they had to go. So there was a lot of that Andy Griffith sort of charm and wisdom to Joe's personality. But then the opposite end of that was like the mischievous Joe. And some days, like, he liked to let me walk in that door at the Tavola Repo, and he would be hiding and jump out and shove his revolver into my back.
Oh, wow.
So all those things were Joe Young.
Yeah.
But again, nonetheless, fond memories.
I never really knew him, other than just dealing with him and, you know, talking to him in the record store. He's always really cool. He'd always help turn us on to good stuff, and just super nice guy every time I go in there. And then, like, for years, I didn't talk to him. And then not long before he passed, we became friends on Facebook, and we were talking on there quite a bit, just, you know, just messaging back and forth about stuff. And it was kind of a shame, because I kept thinking, man, I need to get into Repo and see Joe sometime, like, go in and talk to him. And I just didn't get by there before he passed. And I really feel bad about that. Now that I'm doing this podcast, it's like, man, he's the one that I'd really love to have on here, but there's no way that, well, him and Chris Piegler, and there's a couple other people that I'd love to have that I'll never get the chance to. But at some point, I want to have either, like, one person talk about him, or just talk to several different people about him, put together an episode as a tribute to him.
Sure, that would be a good thing.
Like, maybe go around and talk to several different people and get stories and just cobble together a tribute episode.
I think, I don't know if that was, like, a part of Joe Young innately, or he had to learn that, but I think he possessed something very early on that a lot of us could learn something by, and that's just, don't get too upset about anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The older I get, the easier it is to do that. And the more I realize it's a waste of time to get upset about things you can't control, especially.
Well, one of my most valued friends in this life gave me this bit of advice a few years ago, and I continually try to apply it to my life, although it's a very difficult thing to maintain. It was just one sentence, and he wrote me, because I was going through a difficult time and struggling, he just wrote, "If you can't control yourself, someone else will do it for you."
Mm-hmm.
We suffer a lot of losses in life by split seconds of things happening and and regrets, and then it's too late. As I've said a couple times, many fond memories, but, you know, as is expected, and I'm sure you would say about your life, there's many of those things I would never want to repeat.
Yeah. Oh, there's a lot of things I would not want to repeat. Let's talk a little bit about, so around that time, you were also, we already mentioned Repo Cheapo one time.
That's
so
right.
You worked at Repo Cheapo.
I was there from day one.
Yep.
That was a very hard time in my life. You know, credit where credit's due. I was like 1 foot above being homeless at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And that just synced up like it did by happenstance that Repo Cheapo store was starting.
Mm-hmm.
And Jimmy Repo was really starting that store like to have a viable way to bring Jeff Clayton into the operation of things.
Yeah.
And Jeff Clayton convinced him to give me a job there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the only reason I had a job at that time.
Okay.
I had no transportation and usually no money to eat.
Mm-hmm.
If I ate, typically it was Jeff Clayton or Jimmy Repo buying me a hot dog or two on the way back to where I was staying at the Dairy Queen.
Yeah.
So that job was very valuable to me at that time.
Mm. I loved that store too. It was a fun store to go to and shop at. Find all kinds of cool stuff cheap.
Yeah, I think about that a lot, even today, you know. I helped formulate the business model of that store, but the fact that it was predominantly dollar items made it very difficult to make a success out of it.
I wonder about that. Like, but it was really a lot of cheap stuff, and it was always one of our stops because we could load up on stuff there. I guess if you sold enough of it, but still, it's hard to make money on a dollar.
And, you know, even back then. Yeah, even then, I mean, we're talking 1993. I do remember that the rent on that spot was like over a grand, mm-hmm. even then.
Wow.
So, you know that. Eventually, Jimmy Repo took what was in that store and moved it to South Boulevard, mm-hmm. and I ended up over there as well.
Yeah.
I would have never admitted that at the time, and it's taken me most of my life to admit it as a grown man today. Another difficult but important relationship in my life, me and Jimmy Repo.
Yeah.
Teaching me the ropes and certain things that I needed to learn to be valuable to my life.
Yeah. Well, you've definitely turned it into something these days. We'll talk about that in a little bit as well.
From the very, very bad living situation I briefly explained to you, like, it got a little better for me. I was able to rent this old, big old rundown house. And Brad, my main bandmate in Failure and the Furies, moved in there with me. And I can't really tell you what dissolved the Furies other than it could have been some of us living together, like we just grew apart.
Yeah.
And I can't tell you much about that other than I remember the gist of it. He started spending a lot of time with Greg Clayton, and I think they started playing together and doing some musical project.
I think it was they did Crime Scene 13, or at least he did that down the road.
Right. But, you know, in there too, 1993 would be the year that Gigi Allen died, who was another very important person in my life. Mm-hmm. And a week prior to his death, he was in Charlotte, and just by pure accident, we were over at Jeff Clayton's house, and that's where Anti-Scene had their practice room. Gigi was wanting to go more and more at that time towards outlaw country.
Mm-hmm.
And he had some songs, and we said, what the hell? And just those of us who were there, that became the Carolina Shit Kickers, yeah, yeah. And we recorded Gigi's last record without knowing mm-hmm. the importance of what we were doing. It was just a thrown together, like, spontaneous jam session, really.
Yeah.
And I mean, that the most notable song on that record, that Laying Up With Linda, it really happened in the moment. Gigi was like, I've got these words, these are the chords I've got, you figure out your bass part, which was me. I was playing bass, and mm-hmm. We just figured it out on the spot.
Yeah.
I know a large part of the reason that song has become, like, so famous is the Lemonheads covered it.
Mm-hmm.
None of us have ever gotten a dime from that.
Oh, wow.
So, I do consider that I was there, I think at very much at the birth of, like, Gigi doing his outlaw country thing, which he loved that. I think that's what he really wanted to start doing.
Yeah.
I was the only one in the room that day who wanted to plug in the amps and do a hard-charging punk rock song, and no one else was interested in doing that day. That would have been the last thing like that he did.
Yeah.
But, you know, we can talk about him as much as you like for what time allows right here today, but, you know, this coincides with that, so I want to at least speak on that much. We've already put my life where it was at the time. Very, very mm-hmm. bad time in my life. So the last time I saw Gigi that week before, he knew that. And this will illustrate, like, the sincere, caring side of Gigi Allen that hardly no one knows about whatsoever. He's leaving the room that night where I'm sitting in the chair. We're in Jeff Clayton's house. And he pauses and stops and puts his hand on my shoulder and says, I love you. People didn't get that from Gigi Allen.
Yeah.
That he even, like, had the thought to stop and give that to me
mm-hmm.
in that moment was a tremendous thing to me.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, people ask me all the time still, like, oh, that guy was crazy. Was that real? What was he like? And, you know, they have no idea what it was like to know Gigi Allen, the human being.
Yeah.
A very special person that I don't think we'll ever see the likes of again.
Yeah.
I think you can understand this. Like, one of the most intelligent things I ever heard said about G.G. Allen from someone who was qualified to say it was in that Hated documentary. Most people would hear this and say, what the hell are you talking about? But I understood it immediately when they asked Dino, the Naked drummer, what was G.G. Allen's message? And he turned and said, it was that there's not enough love in the world. I understood that duality of Gigi even back during that time. There's that, and then there's the guy who knew it was a necessity to put danger back into rock and roll.
Yeah.
And that's very profound that Dino understood that.
Yeah.
That one statement, isn't that what produced Gigi Allen that the world knew?
Mm-hmm.
How would you or I have turned out if we would have had to, as children, been digging our own grave?
Yeah, no, that's pretty crazy.
He and I sat on the couch in Clayton's house and watched Hated together for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And when it got to that part where he's sitting alone in the shitty motel room and he's just repeating, I hate you motherfuckers, over and over, I took an elbow to him. I said, you're so full of shit. You don't hate me. And he takes his bottle and shoves it at me. He goes, oh, have some jam. But he dared to be different, and he was far more than meets the eye. Mm-hmm. And as I said, a very, very important person from that time of my life. And I'm so glad that our paths crossed, at least for a little while.
Yeah.
And I ended up, I'm sure, you know the succession here. Like, when that GG Anti-Scene Murder Junkies release came out, it first came out on that New Rose out of France, and it sounded terrible. So when Jeff Skipsky wanted to re-release it through Baloney Shrapnel, Clayton and I went back in and remixed it, and I think what we achieved in turning it around was astounding.
Yeah.
We gave it, like, you know, a snarl and a bite, which it needed to have.
Mm-hmm.
That's such a great record.
Yeah.
And I know GG would have felt differently, but I don't think it needed all that spoken word in between the songs. I think it broke the momentum.
Yeah.
But as we've touched on already, and you know, because you played the show, we all helped pay for GG's tombstone.
Yeah, me and Eric were talking about this last night. He's like, I don't remember a lot about that show. I said, you know why you don't remember a lot about the show? Because we only played like a song and a half before our guitarist broke a string and then just could not get it in tune. And like after 2 minutes, I'm like, man, let's just get off the stage. One of us said, let's just get off the stage. Because it was not working. It's like, we're just not going to hold the show up anymore. So we got off the stage. And I really feel bad about that. But, you know, we were there.
The chaos conveyed through those pictures you gave me. What do you remember about all that?
I just remember it just not a lot. It just, like, I think it turned into this big jam session kind of. And like there's I've got one picture. I need to show you that one of Phil Irwin playing, like, holding a chair up on his guitar neck like he's playing slide guitar. But I think that was from the same night. But yeah, I just remember a lot of shows that we did at Heretics devolved by the end of the show, too. It was just one of these things that, especially with SJA, we'd throw biscuits all over the place. And like I said, that was something about that place. Like, you can get away with doing this stuff there.
Yeah, when you mentioned that before and again now, you know, you wouldn't know this, but that SG that Phil was doing that to was my SG.
Yeah.
I had just traded somebody for it, and I was sitting there watching what he was doing, and I was like, oh, no, what are you doing? I mean, because it was a legit, like, vintage SG.
So, I don't know where you want to go from, we kind of had stopped with G.G. Allen, Carolina Shit Kickers. Did you play music beyond that?
I really didn't.
Was it like a conscious decision to stop playing, or did you just not play for a while? And just, because when I stopped playing for my short period of time, or short as 7 years, at first it was just like, well, I won't play for right now. I'll start something eventually. And then it just turned into me not playing for a while. But some people just consciously quit. They're like, I'm done. I don't want to play anymore.
I mean, I kept going for a little while with those songs we had in the Furies. But as you and I already touched on privately, I just found it like such a chore to like babysit and keep that going with band members who had substance abuse problems.
Yeah, yeah. I never had to deal with that, but it would, well, we talked about that privately earlier too. I kind of do, but yeah.
I was trying to make sure we touch on other notable things from that time. Most people would not know that I produced the first two Buzz Oven records.
Okay.
Kurt Fisher, we went to high school together. That's how long we've known each other. And I ended up traveling, running live sound for them. And, you know, intermingled with that was a process of me ending up producing their first two records. They did them at that Peninsula Sound at Lake Norman, where all of us did our stuff back then. And I think I only got a credit on one of them. And because I was always a big COC fan, the record comes out, and I remember the first time I saw it, Kirk Fisher comes up to hand it to me in the parking lot at the Pterodactyl, and he thought that was funny to put on the finished record, Robbie Mullen, to change my last name to Mullen, like Reed Mullen.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just stared at him like, that's in no way funny.
Yeah.
I did the work to be a part of this and make you a good record. So that's probably like why most people wouldn't know that I was involved with those first two records.
Yeah.
But the stories I could tell you about going on tour with them and running live sound. I mean, you didn't know what was going to happen from day to day with the cops or somebody getting beat up or getting detained, or, you know, it was just like from moment to moment, you had no idea what was going to happen.
Yeah.
But, you know, for a while there, they became a big force in heavy music.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's how far we went back to. We went to East Mecklenburg together, and then I ended up part of the beginnings of the Buzz Oven thing.
Yeah.
And some of these things, you know, like I've told you earlier, I won't remember until people say, like, well, us too, or us too. Like, I don't always remember all the bands I ran sound for back then, because I became the guy for a while, and if one of these bands needed someone to go out for a weekend with them and run live sound for a couple shows, I would go.
Yeah.
But the anti-scene thing in particular, that was very fortunate. You know, today that lineup is the closest to my heart, and probably for that reason, you know, I was spending all that time with them running their sound during the Southern Hostility era. Mm-hmm. So I was out with them when Steve Sadler was the drummer.
Yeah, yeah.
And I mean, as far as their chance to reach a commercial success or get bigger, I think I would never be able to dispute that would have been around the time of Eat More Possum. But my personal favorite time was Southern Hostility.
Yeah, yeah. We came along and found out about them right before Eat More Possum came out, so that was the big one for me. But yeah, I love all those records.
That was around that same time that Nirvana couldn't have blown up any bigger, and I don't know how he became aware, but at least Tom O'Keefe was aware that Nirvana had openly cited anti-scene as an influence. That was the time to go with it.
Yeah. I think they'd have done something.
Well, I mean, the fact that they even did one single on Sub Pop was pretty notable.
Mm-hmm. I mean, they had their own success in their own way.
Sure, sure.
But I think they could have been a little bit bigger than they.
If it were me, I'd, you know, I'm just speaking from like my time involved in playing in bands, like. Even during that brief time I did it, that got very old to me, like lugging heavy gear and getting paid a little to nothing.
Yeah.
Like, you would like what you do artistically, like, to be your life and your means of income.
Oh, yeah, I'd love that, but I'm still doing it these days just because it's still fun to me to get out there and do that. And now I'm adding lugging records into the mix, too. Like, man, I'm getting too old for this. I got to get a partner. A young partner. Good back.
Well, you said your daughter.
Yeah, yeah. I don't make her lug records around. Maybe her boyfriend.
This is your initiation.
Yeah. They want to get married next year, so. All right, come carry some records for me. Let's talk. So you stopped playing music, but you... After you just music kind of fizzled out for you, you've still sort of been involved in music all this time. For the past 30 years, you said you've been stagehand. I forget how you put it. You put it in more technical terms like your certifications and everything or whatever. But I just a stagehand. I'm going to leave it with that.
Yeah, I work for still to this day. IOTC 322, you know. That's the local chapter of the Stagehand Union, the national. So that puts me at the forefront for all the big stuff at Spectrum and Ovens and PNC and Uptown and, you know, you name it. I've worked them, and some people I've worked like 3 and 4 times.
Yeah. I know here recently, at least you've done Eagles, Billie Eilish. So anytime somebody like that comes through town, you're helping set up and tear down?
A real, real big show, you can pretty much guarantee I'm on it.
Yeah.
The skill set for the day will vary. Yeah, but we do everything from lights to video to sound to unloading the truck and loading it all back up.
Mm-hmm.
Very little do people realize when they come in and sit down in their seat to watch a concert that people have been there since dawn, usually making it happen.
Yeah.
And we'll be there sometimes till 4 a.m. putting it all back in the trucks.
Yeah, and I guess my assumption was that when these tours would come around, they would have their own people that set up and tore down. But it makes more sense for just to have local unions that do that.
That's right.
Because you don't want to transport that many people around the country.
That's right. They bring a skeleton crew with department heads who will supervise us and what needs to be done specifically.
Yeah. That makes sense. I never really thought about it that way. I don't know if you have any more stories from that or anything else you want to say about that.
Well, it just came to me what we were kind of skipping over. You know, back in the early days of me starting out as a union stagehand, through Tom O'Keefe, I got the opportunity to go out as Ryan Adams' guitar tech.
Oh, okay.
Back then, it was still Whiskey Town. It was the very end of Whiskey Town. Mm-hmm. It was right before he got really big. And that was a nonstop adventure. We were out for a month, and we had me, Tom, and a sound man and the band all in one cargo van with a trailer. And we started from Charlotte and went all the way to Vancouver, Canada, came all the way back.
Yeah.
We went to Texas and Oregon and California, and that tour was quite an adventure. I quickly learned that Ryan had a short fuse. I found the humor in that and made the best of it.
Yeah.
I'm not sure he always thought that was the best. But, you know, that's just my personality. That aside, I would never take away from him that, you know, throughout that month, there was always a moment during those shows where he made the band go away and he'd sit up there alone with an acoustic guitar, and it was pure magic.
Yeah.
I sat there with the best seat in the house and undeniably knew in those moments, like, there's a genius on that stage.
Yeah.
So in that way alone, it was very valuable.
Mm-hmm.
But, geez, I mean, one incident in particular, and I do believe that was in Portland. Ryan liked to, as we came to a stoplight in traffic, he had these glasses he would put on that had like a pig nose attached to them, and he liked to lean out the passenger window drunk and taunt people, other people in traffic. And this one time it turned into like a full on street brawl where the drummer was like getting out of the back of the van to like intercede in the conflict. Mm-hmm. But Tom's driving the van and he's not aware of what's happening. So the light turns and he takes off with the drummer halfway out of the back of the van. Things like that every few days.
Yeah. Always an adventure.
But, what an experience to be with someone like that, like right before they become a superstar.
Yeah.
I mean, there must have been between him and the lead guitarist and the bass player, I would guesstimate that I had to take care of 16 guitars at all times and have them pretty much all ready to go.
Yeah.
And when we arrive at these venues and the band would take off and leave me to set up everything, and when it was over, the band would take off and leave me to pack everything. Yeah. I did all of it.
Yeah.
And places like the Fillmore in San Francisco, that's not fun because you had to get the stuff up and come back down this tiny elevator.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to many, many great places, but most of them, like San Francisco, you're like, oh, there's Alcatraz. That's like all you got to see because you were going to the venue and leaving.
Yeah, going to the venue, setting up, tearing down, and leaving. On to the next one.
I mean, I was doing the union stagehand thing early enough that I worked with some legends. Like, I worked with Red Dog when he was still with the Allman Brothers. Mm. And, you know, you experience everything you think you would and more, and all different types of personalities, and some celebrities who are grateful and humble and friendly, and others that don't want to even see the side of you.
Oh, yeah.
It's quite the eye-opener.
About how many would you say are that way, that don't want to see the side of you? Are there a lot of them? Or maybe not quite don't want to see the side of you, but the ones that are less than friendly.
The ones that stand out in my mind in particular more than anyone else would be Stevie Nicks, Reba McEntire, Page and Plant.
It doesn't surprise me with any of those names, kind of.
Oh, and most recently Bob Dylan.
That definitely doesn't surprise me.
He wouldn't even come in or exit the venue until all of us were like secured in a room.
Mm-hmm. Now Reba might surprise me a little bit. She seems like the kind of. But then again, she's also a queen of country.
And anything involving Maynard usually ends up that way.
Yeah.
We usually end up working him at the old Coliseum.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, from going there for years, right behind the stage, there's that big steel rolling door.
Mm-hmm.
He makes all the stagehands get behind that rolling door and have it closed before he'll appear.
Oh, wow. That's not a surprise either, really. Some of you know, you mentioned the names, it's like, that doesn't really surprise me. Or even maybe a little bit, but then again.
I remember, you know, how many have they done? The first Kiss Farewell Tour.
Mm-hmm.
Ted Nugent opened, and he had no... They don't really do so much of dead seats anymore. You know what I'm talking about, like beside and behind the stage.
Yeah.
Ted Nugent had no problem with us sitting in those seats and watching him. When it was time for Kiss, Gene made all of us go away like nobody was going to watch it for free.
Mm-hmm. Again, not a shock. Kind of a shock that Ted Nugent was cool with it, but then again, that actually seems like Ted. Yeah, man, y'all watched the show from back there.
But pretty much anybody you could name, I've worked it in the... You know, let's do the converse side of that. The people that have gone out of their way to be grateful. Steve Perry.
Mm-hmm.
Steven Tyler. Graham Nash, Pearl Jam, David Lee Roth.
Oh, wow.
David Lee Roth, the last time Van Halen came in 2015, came out on the loading dock and thanked all of us.
Wow. That seems like Dave, too, though. You'd think that he has this big ego, but I think he's pretty much a really cool, down-to-earth guy with an ego that gets in the way sometimes, mostly with band members.
You can. This one in particular stands out, and you can imagine what that meant to me. The first time I ever worked Skinner at the Coliseum that got torn down out by the airport.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
They're coming in from the bus. The first thing Gary Rossington and Ricky Medlock do is come up to me and shake my hand.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what does that take? And that makes all the difference.
Exactly, yeah. I think some of them may just be too afraid that a handshake's going to turn into a, oh, let me get a picture and an autograph and let me tell you how much I love you. And they just don't want to deal with that.
Well, I spoke to Medlock within the past few years again at one of those Carolina Rebellions, mm-hmm. working that. And for some reason, they got off the bus and they were coming up the back of the outdoor stage up the runway. And he sees me and comes straight towards me, you know, like we know each other. And, hey, brother, how you doing today? And I was like, I'm doing fine. I hope you are. I said, do you know that I saw you play like way back at Kidnappers in Charlotte? And he goes, Kidnappers? Whoo, I can't tell you the stuff that happened in that place. We'll keep that a secret.
That's the kind of stories I like.
I mean, isn't that what you think Ricky Medlock would be? He's that person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A lot of people don't like him. I don't know why. But I also don't understand why he's playing in that band instead of doing Blackfoot.
Mm. More money, I guess.
That would probably be the answer. Yeah.
But wouldn't it be good to see a Blackfoot reunion?
Yes, sir. I think it needs to happen.
Yeah. So now you have to work a lot of shows that you, by artists, you don't really care for, too, I'm sure. Like, I can imagine you're a big Billie Eilish fan. But then again, maybe Billie Eilish is okay.
Billie Eilish pays the same money as all the rest of them.
Okay. That's a good answer.
Yeah, that was working that recently. That was the second longest day I ever had, 22 hours straight.
Oh, wow.
The only thing that outlasted it was the Gloria Estefan musical at Ovens. I was there for 23 hours.
Yeah. That would be a fun one to be at for 23 hours, too. I say that facetiously.
This is something really interesting for you. When I worked the Eagles the other day, I was a truck loader, and I would typically pay more attention to old-timers who have something to say than other people.
Mm-hmm.
And this one driver starts talking to me, and he only had to lay one sentence on me, like something about driving them in 76. And I said, wait, you were driving the Eagles in 1976? He said, oh, yeah. And here he is driving them in 2022.
Mm-hmm.
And then he went on to all these other old stories about going from the Eagles to, then I started driving for a band that nobody had ever heard of in 78 called Van Halen. I said, so what was the industry standard back then? What was a big show? How many trucks were you hauling for the Eagles? He said, three trucks.
Mm-hmm.
That was the most.
How many is it now?
The average now is 15 to 18 wheelers.
Mm-hmm.
He said they were doing 80,000 seat arenas with three trucks.
Yeah.
But just those opportunities I'm afforded when I get to be around people like that, I'm just fascinated that someone's still on the road,
mm-hmm.
driving rock and roll that's been doing it since 76.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
We got to the back of one of those trucks unloading, and there's the load bars, and there's a road case behind it, and the production manager says, don't touch those load bars, don't touch the case that's behind it. We're like, why? What's in there? He said, That wasn't supposed to come out on tour. That's the original Eagles Hotel California neon.
Oh, wow. But it ended up on tour with them?
Uh-huh. Sitting in the back of the truck every day.
Yeah, yeah. I guess it's safer there. Turn that truck around and send it back.
Yeah, you'd think Don Henley would have had it sent back.
Well, you want to talk about the record store now?
Let's do it.
So, we're sitting here in your record store, Spooky's. What's the full name of the store?
Spooky's Records and Collectibles.
Okay, so let me make sure I got that in there right. And it's located in Gastonia.
902A Bessemer City Road, Gastonia.
Real easy access off of 85, about a mile and a half off of 85.
Yeah, just a block from the second Walmart.
Yeah, yeah. And you've been open since right before Thanksgiving, I believe.
Roundabouts Thanksgiving.
Yeah, because I came in here Thanksgiving Day. So you've been collecting, like me, I'm a collector too. You've been collecting all this stuff for years. Look around. It's more than records. There's a lot of records in here. There's a lot of records. You got movies. I haven't even dug into the movies yet. Ton of t-shirts, stuff all over the walls. 45, 7 inches. You don't have comic books in here, do you?
Just a few sitting on the table there. And I do have a good bit at home. Just haven't made their way in here yet.
Toys, 8-tracks, a little bit of everything. It's the kind of store that I've been in a few times. I'm not as much as I'd like to, but I still haven't looked at everything yet.
That's the general reaction of people who come in, that there's no way they'll ever look at everything.
And that's what I like in a store, because I always want to be able to find something new or go, ooh, let me look at this today, because last time I was here, I was over in this area. So it's a cool store you got.
I appreciate that. It was a lot of hard work as well as a labor of love. And if you look around here, it would tell the story of my life much more than you may realize. Mm-hmm. I mean, the reason why those wrestling posters from the Crockett's Mid-Atlantic in the 70s are even hanging there is because my father was beginning to take me to those matches in 1976.
Yeah. So now, was it always a dream of yours to open up a store ever since working at Repo, or did you have aspirations to maybe do a record store at a younger age? I know as soon as I got into records, the first thing I was like, I'd love to work in a record store, love to own a record store, but I just never thought it'd be a possibility.
Yeah, I do believe that was an aspiration of mine prior to working at Repo. I remember at one point my father asking me, which never happened, if you'd inherit a sizable sum of money, what would you do with it? And even at a young age, I said, number one, buy a house so I wouldn't have to worry about a place to live anymore. Mm-hmm. And number two, open my own record store.
Yeah.
But as far as the collecting, that was, I think most people that are in any way like me would agree, that was born into me.
Mm-hmm.
My grandmother had lived in the same house my whole life. They built it in Charlotte in 59. So she had a big old ranch house and giant attic that spanned the whole length of the house. So it had several family generations of stuff up there.
Mm-hmm.
So nothing was more my favorite thing to do than to get in the attic and go through the stuff up there.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's certainly where some of that came from.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you could find anything up there from, which I still have, like a Nazi SS helmet from World War II, to my dad's old comic books and baseball cards, to my great-grandmother's Victorian clothing. Yeah. All that stuff was still up there.
Yeah. I think my collecting came from, because when I was a kid, I had toys and stuff, but I don't remember ever holding on to anything. And then one time when I was a teenager, I realized, I wonder what ever happened to all my toys. And I started deciding I was going to try to start buying them, but that was about the same time that I also got into records. So for a long time, I just collected records. And well, I started with cassettes and then records. And then Then a little bit older, I started buying up all the toys from my kid, from my childhood. So I started, got into that a little bit later, just sort of like, well, I got the money now to buy this stuff. I want to buy it and keep it. And at an early age, I started going to thrift stores. My dad would take me to thrift stores all the time when I was a kid. And so even when I became a teenager, like thrift store every week. And just if I saw something that was interesting, I was going to buy it and keep it. And I've got stuff now that I've had since I was a teenager just picked up at thrift stores. But some people like Eric, my friend Eric, he's not a collector at all. He just doesn't quite get it at all. Like he can live with hardly anything. But for me, it's like I just love having that stuff around.
I'd say more people than not don't get it. Mm-hmm. And if you share with them like the rarity and the value of something, they think you're a fool for not selling it.
Yeah. I look at things sometimes, I'm like, man, I could sell that and get some money, but then I wouldn't have that thing anymore. You know?
Like, you know, any thinking human being would do. I struggle with that a lot. Like, not only these things it takes us a lifetime to accumulate that we value and love so much and like to have around us all the time, but knowledge, the fact that we die and then what?
Yeah.
What was the purpose?
Yeah. Can't take it with you.
No.
I was telling somebody just the other day that I really, you know, feel bad for my daughters whenever I die because they're going to have a lot of stuff to go through. But I'm hoping that by that point I've got it set up for them they can make a little bit of money off of it. But yeah, I kind of got to the point myself to where it's like, you know, I've got all this stuff. Now I kind of want to share it. And so I started doing pop-ups and dabbling into that. And one of the things I've really struggled with is at first I was selling exclusively out of my collection. And some other things I picked up at thrift stores, like, oh, I can sell this one down the road. But one of the things I struggled with was, well, I don't really want to give up my records. But I kind of got to the point of where if I'm buying and selling, I'll always have new stuff coming in. So, but the new stuff that I have coming in, sometimes it's hard to let go of that. Just because, again, being a collector, it's hard to let go of it, but a part of me still wants to share it with everybody.
Well, as you can imagine, this process was very daunting. Mm-hmm. And in getting all this stuff in here, and I've still got five times as much that's not here. Like, things made their way in here that I did not intend to make their way in here.
Yeah.
So I'll be standing at the counter, you know, unavoidably, and someone comes up with something that's one of my records.
Yeah.
I feel like I have to sell it. That's just a hit I have to take.
Yeah. I still like, even with my last pop-up, I went through back through my collection. I was like, somebody else might need this. It's just the way I started looking at it. That's just something I'm kind of doing for fun right now because I enjoy records so much. And again, like a lot of my stuff I've collected over the years, especially some of my toys, I just don't have room for them anymore. So it's a way to kind of get rid of some of that stuff and clear up some room. And it's a way in the meantime for me to learn more about my records and talk to more people about my records. That's one of the things I love about doing that. So I don't necessarily have to have a record store. I can go do a pop-up every couple of months and get that same experience. Well, but like I said earlier, it's a lot of backbreaking work too.
And unless it's something crazy, crazy rare, and we get a hankering one day, we can get it back, right?
Exactly. That's what I've said plenty of times. Like, that record will find its way back to me. I've already had one that found its way back, so. And that was without looking for it.
But, you know, some of what we live for is this, right? Like, this woman came in here the other day with a box.
Oh, wow.
And started pulling this stuff out. And this was only one of seven.
Yeah.
All she told me was, I have a trunk full of 45s. And I go out to the trunk, and it's almost complete junk and dirty and scratchy and shoved in the old metal 45 racks.
Yep.
And, you know, a customer's coming in, another customer. So I'm like, I need to go back in there and tend to that. And she's like, well, you take that box, and I'll follow you in with a couple more. When we get in here, Mike, she starts setting these, what I'm pointing at, so original 60s Godzilla Aurora monster model. Mm-hmm. She starts setting these in front of me, lined across the front of the counter.
Yeah.
In the box I never saw in the trunk.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a lot of what we do it for,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
For, like, those moments.
Mm-hmm.
And I've already had today two people come in here wanting to buy them all. And even if I end up selling one or two of them or all of them, I'd just like to have them for a little while. Yeah. I'm not ready to sell them.
You got to enjoy it for a little bit and then let somebody else enjoy it. That's part of the fun. It's like, I have this thing.
But these had been in her relative's basement. They're cleaning out like since the 60s. Mm-hmm.
Does this glow in the dark?
They're all the glow editions.
Yeah, yeah. Man, that is really cool.
You know, in the box was Godzilla, Dracula, Frankenstein, Phantom of the Opera, Barnabas Collins, and Jekyll and Hyde.
Mm-hmm. You got them all?
Yeah.
This is the only one you have in the store?
No, they're all here.
They're all over there. I'll look at them before we go. You'll have to pull them out right now.
These crazy looking hot rod models with the distorted tires. Yeah. Those came from her.
Oh, wow.
This came from her, which, you know, looks like a hybrid between a police paddy wagon and the Munsters car.
Yeah, I love finding stuff like that.
But if only I could get in the basement.
Yeah, really.
But most of it couldn't be redeemed. Like, it was just missing too many parts. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But, you know, her seeing my signage outside for records is the reason I got these.
Yeah.
But, you know, regardless of whether I had desires or aspirations to do this before my time at Repo, that was a very important, like, training ground for me doing what I am today.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure it made it easier what you got here.
Because I was left there alone a lot to, like, run the entire ship. And at one point, when it moved to South Boulevard, it was just me for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And I was doing the selling, the buying, the ordering, the totals for the day, like everything that needed to be done, the stocking, I was taking care of it.
Mm. Now, that's one thing you don't do here, though, is you don't really keep up with new releases and order new stuff.
No, I haven't ventured there yet. Yeah. Maybe we'll get into that eventually.
Yeah, but for right now, it's a used record store.
So far, the revenue from all the used product is bringing in what I need to make.
Yeah, yeah. And you buy, sell,
and trade.
Yeah, obviously, like we talked about the Godzilla model.
Yeah. Other than the vinyl records, you know, of particular interest are old original wrestling or concert posters, original old tour shirts, tour programs, ticket stubs, candid pictures of rock and roll or wrestling. I love all those things.
Yeah. And you had some help getting the place open, right? You've already mentioned Freddie Hutch. He helped you get this place open.
He did. He was a big help to me. And Steve Sadler, the former drummer of Anti-Scene, actually came up here and helped me with some manual labor.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't have to do that. He's a lawyer these days, yeah. You know. So that meant a lot to me, and I thought that was really cool that could come full circle.
Yeah.
That people that were that important a part of my past, like, mm-hmm. came back to be a part of this.
Yeah.
The person who did my Spookies logo that's out there on the window is a very old friend of mine going back to junior high. Mm-hmm. He's a graphic designer now in Raleigh, Kevin Evans.
And since you mentioned the name of the store again, the name of the store is, you named it after your cat.
I did. Correct?
Yeah.
That's my little female cat, Spooky. A few years ago, I ran a band rehearsal building in Charlotte called Noda Studios, mm-hmm. and she showed up there in the parking lot one day, just a tiny little thing, feral outside, and was able to trap her in a carrier with some tuna fish and took her to get her initial going over in shots, and the Humane Society thought she was about 3 months old. How she survived outside there all that time, I can't tell you.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's 7 years old now.
Okay. But you do have a little bit of everything in here. Old magazines, CDs. You have any cassettes?
cassettes.
Yeah, cassettes.
The 8-tracks haven't gone over very well.
Well, I don't expect them to. I've started collecting 8-tracks myself, and I haven't put them or thought about selling them yet. I've got a few that I've thought about putting on eBay, like a Kraftwerk, and I can't remember what else, but I kind of like them. I just think they're cool. They take me back to like my early experience with music. And my parents had this like Sears console stereo record player, 8-track radio. I could play with 8-track and the radio, but I think they let me play records sometimes. But when I was really young, basically it was 8-tracks because you could put them in, pull them out, not really mess anything up. And I just remember doing that, like putting it in, pulling it out, putting it in, pressing the button, changing the channel on it. I remember like they had Meatloaf, Bat Out of Hell. And I just remember looking at it going, man, this looks scary. And then putting it in and playing it, going, what is this? This does not sound like what the front of it looks like. But so 8-tracks just take me back to that time. And so I got on a mission to buy an 8-track player a year or so ago. And as soon as I decided to try to find one, that one popped up at Goodwill. Basically, I've probably seen them a bunch of times and just not thought about buying one. And as soon as I decided to get one, I bought one. Then I started thinking, man, I need to get one that records so I can put Van Huskins on 8-track, which I still haven't done. But about a week later, I found one that recorded. Took it home.
Oh,
records,
wow.
Fine.
So, wow, yeah.
I just haven't found the time to actually figure out all the how I'm going to do it all. Because, of course, 8-tracks are tricky.
I've never seen one that records.
But I want to do it eventually, just because. I don't know. There's probably a few people that would be interested in buying one. But for the most part, it's just to say I did it.
My most vivid memory of 8-tracks, you know, us growing up in the general same time period, they weren't cheap. My father going to buy a new one at the record bar and putting it in the car player and it coming all unraveled and him yelling out, son of a bitch. And he always had a bad temper and he would just like rip it out of the player and throw it straight out the window. Yeah. But yeah, through him, I mean, I would have listened on 8-track to everything from Buddy Holly to Jim Croce to he loved those. That's very important to mention. He loved all those K-Tel compilations, and that's the reason that I would have first heard people like Black Sabbath and Alice Cooper.
Yeah. K-Tel compilations were big for me too when I was a kid, because when I got my record player, I think I got a couple of those. But then also, like, it wasn't Food Lion back then, I don't remember what it was, but the grocery store had records. Like, in one of those little, like, where they had magazines, they'd have records in it, and you'd find K-Tel compilations there all the time. They were always, like, fairly cheap records. So that's where I would go when we'd go to the grocery store. I was going to look at those records, and then y'all could find me on the way out, and I'd usually take one home with me.
Some of my first records came from the basement at Belk. Do you remember them having records?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, back then, a lot of places had records. Like, I think you'd get them at Eckerd, like drugstores and stuff.
And when I got to where I could go places, I loved going to that Kmart on Independence. Mm-hmm. They'd have those budget bins of VHS and cassettes. And, I mean, I got everything from a bootleg, weird-looking Black Sabbath Paranoid cassette to... Mm-hmm. To Texas Chainsaw Massacre when it was first on VHS.
Yeah.
And it didn't hurt that it sat right next to Infinity's End.
Yeah.
I got my first Venom t-shirt in there.
Oh, yeah.
My first COC shirt.
Yeah, I remember we used to go there a lot on our trips to Charlotte. You know, we'd hit, like, Milestone Record, Repo Record, Infinity's End, Superior Feet. We'd usually go in there. For comic book stores would go into that. That kind of went away, though. We were in comic books for a little while, but eventually records took over our comic book budget. But Infinity's End was one we'd go to just to buy stickers or t-shirts and stuff. We didn't care about all the pot stuff, not back then, but we'd go there and just buy t-shirts and stickers and things.
Yeah, I'd say, as we mentioned earlier, the store I spent the most time in had to be Camelot Music.
Yeah.
That's also where I went to buy my concert tickets.
Yeah. I went in there quite a bit, but it was, you know, by then we were already going to Repo and Milestone, so Camelot was a place we'd go to if we still had some time and still had some money left over. But my experience with Camelot, though, was like all in Gastonia at the mall. So that was where we'd go to buy our stuff before we got to Charlotte.
Okay.
It was Camelot and Record Bar at the mall in Charlotte. And Sound Shop in Shelby, just wherever we'd get our parents to take us to the mall.
And most people don't remember. They only remember the Samir Milestone Records. Like, when it started, it was Jeff Lowry.
Yeah, see, I don't remember that. Samir was running it whenever I started going. It was over at, you know, on Central Avenue.
Yeah, he started it on Montford Drive, mm-hmm. and then it moved over there by Butler Seafood on Moorhead.
Yeah.
And both those before the Samir thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when I started going, it was Samir, and I think we'd always go. We started going there first because we went to the comic book store, and then they were right around the corner from Heroes. Then we'd go down to Repo. But I think eventually Repo was the first place we went to. Plus the comic books kind of went away.
You went to Repo when it was in the little strip shopping center down there on the right if you're going away from downtown. The place that's the Asian Beauty Supply now.
Yeah. But it's funny how many people I talk to and we all tell the same story. It's like, you know, we come from the outskirts of Charlotte just to go to Repo and Milestone and maybe get some comic books and all the same places.
Laying up with Linda used to be fun. Nobody ever paid the rent. There was never anything done then. One day I killed her. Now I'm on the run. But living with Linda used to be fun. Living with Linda, she did what I wanted her to do. But living with Linda wasn't always easy to do. So one day I killed her. Now I'm on the run. But living with Linda used to be fun. Playing up with Linda, never had a responsibility. She was a dancer at night, or I was rocking and rolling till three. We drank, we never saw the daylight. That was the death of her and me. Then one day I just got bored and killed her. Never had a quarter. Everything we owned was in hock. Then I got pissed and killed her. So now I'm on the run. But let me tell you, living with Linda used to be fun.
Well, I don't know. Is there anything else you want to say about the store or...
I'd just like to reiterate what I've put out there on social media, that I've tried to do something here where almost anybody from any walk of life can come in here and find something that they would like,
mm-hmm.
that would like bring a little more joy to their day that they wouldn't have had already.
Yeah.
That's what a lot of customers expressed at Repo during those days, that they appreciated about me, that whether they wanted to come in and talk about Marvin Gaye or some old Bill Monroe bluegrass, I could talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's just what I've tried to do here, like have a cross-section of all kinds of things that would interest different people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you've got all genres of music, or most genres of music, at least, I should say. And just all kinds of other cool stuff. Like I said, keep looking around. You'll see something you didn't see first five times you came in.
And as I tell the customers when they come in, like, to please keep checking back, because I will have something new every time.
Mm-hmm.
I know what that's like as a customer to come somewhere and you see the same stuff in the same place every time. I'm not going to be that store.
Yeah.
Because that gets boring and frustrating.
Yeah. Because once you've looked through it and realized you didn't need anything, they're not going to have anything again the next time.
Yeah.
I mean, every now and then I'll go to a place and there's something I've passed over several times and I'll decide to get it. But it's always nice to have new, fresh options.
That's the Easter egg hunt, right?
Yep. For sure.
Well, I appreciate you coming here and taking the time to do this with me.
I appreciate you doing this.
This has been a Gabba Gabba Hunt.
I enjoy getting to know you better.
Yeah, she just right in front of me going, I'm going through these junky records and she starts setting these up on the counter. And you try to act normal.
Yeah. I'd be like, oh shit. I would say that. Don't get too excited.